Hey gang, we all know Spotify has become the ultimate app destination for music lovers. I have an account and I love it. I find new music by following Tastemaker playlists, and I make my own playlist that I share featuring music from guests that has been on the show. But did you know that aside from millions of songs, Spotify now has all of your favorite podcasts, including How Did I Get Here? Yes, all of your podcasts are available on Spotify. Just go to Spotify.com or download the app from your app store, and don't forget to follow How Did I Get Here? That's Spotify. Millions of songs, thousands of podcasts. Let's get down. Attention musicians of all levels. It's not always easy picking out a song by ear. Sometimes you need a little help. Well, I have the app for you. Whether you're a professional musician or a beginner, Ultimate Guitar is an amazing app. For just $2.99, you get the chords and tabs on guitar, bass, or ukulele for over a million songs. They're all available at your fingertips. You also get tools like a tuner, metronome, chord library, lessons, videos, and more. You can find out any song you want. It also has like transpose button. It has auto scroll that you can change the speed to so you can play along with the song. A lot of the songs have the lyrics there so you can sing along with them. Ultimate Guitar is an amazing app. Just go to ultimateguitar.com or download the app to your phone today and start playing. Start playing any song you want. Ultimate Guitar, that's the place for you. Let's get down.
How did I get here? And now here is your host, Johnny Howdy.
All right, hello, I'm Johnny, I'm your host. Welcome to the show. I hope you guys have all had a good weekend, whatever it is you did this weekend. I was really saddened to see that news about what happened in Houston at the Travis Scott concert. 8 people died. I'm sure you've seen it. I'm sure you've seen all the news reports about it. Really, really tragic. It's really sad because it's something that didn't really have to happen. You know, that's one of those things that didn't have to happen. Like, you understand what happened at that Who concert in 1975 in Cleveland because they were just starting to have massive amounts of people in like a general admission way coming into a place to see an artist. It was the first time that happened. That was like 50 years ago, man. You know what I mean? Like, it had 50 years to get it together. My heart goes out to the families of people that lost loved ones in that. And you know, it's a very tragic thing to our industry that's already had like a pretty tragic couple of years. And I'm not talking about Travis Scott himself. I don't know what all he had to do with it. I haven't really looked into all of that stuff. I'm just talking about the people that work, the roadies, the stagehands. All these people have been out of work for a couple of years. You know what I mean? Have shit like this go down and jeopardize even further is just a travesty. So I'm sad to hear about that. Other than that, I had a pretty good weekend. I did. I got back to work with Skyrocket. We played a wedding reception on Friday night. Some people that had gotten married during COVID, and they had a big party. And it was really fun. Really great crowd. A lot of crowd interaction. There was a lot of crowd interaction. It was a small, you know, gatherings now are pretty small in that level, you know, like those kind of like, hey, we're having a thing. There's going to be like 50 people there. So it was a lot of fun. We had a great time. It was here in Austin, so it was nice to be able to come home. Saturday, we played out at Spicewood Vineyards, which it was a public show, and tickets were available. I think it was sold out. It was pretty packed. It was pretty insane. There was a moment at that show. Do you guys remember a few years ago, if you watched television, there was a commercial, like a Cialis commercial, and there was a band of dudes, and they're, you know, a little older, playing, and they're out in a field at like a vineyard playing? Well, that's the gig we played. And nothing against Spicewood Vineyards, just us in that backdrop reminded me of that fucking Cialis commercial because of our age and all that stuff. And I really, I couldn't stop thinking about it the whole time I was playing. I was shocked. I was appalled. And I thought it was fucking hilarious. So anyway, we'll be in Houston this week. If you live in Houston, we'll be there Friday, November 12th, this Friday. playing at Last Concert Cafe. So you can find us at skyrocketheband.com. You can get tickets through there. Go to Last Concert Cafe in Houston. I don't know. I guess it's lastconcertcafe.com. That's what I think it might be. Anyway, good times with Skyrocket playing and stuff. Sunday, I took Rosie, my dog, over to The Bubble. It's a recording studio here in Austin. I'm about to go in and start doing this Austin Music Foundation record over the month of November. You'll be hearing a lot about it. A lot of great artists. I'll tell you about that later. But anyway, we went out there yesterday to do some stuff. Me and my friend Einar, who's been one of my best friends since like 1990. And so for 30 years, we've been best friends. He got a dog named Boba, who's around the same age as Rosie and just as crazy. And they play insanely. So, you know, we get them together and they play. But yesterday we went over there for like about 6 hours and those dogs went nuts. I mean, they went nuts. They did not stop running or wrestling for that whole time. Rosie is in her kennel. Like, she chose to go in her kennel now. This is the next day. This is Monday when I'm doing this. She went in her kennel and she's laying down. She's like, I'm done with this. This is it. Einar sent me a text this morning that said, oh shit, man, I think we broke our dogs. Anyway, she had a blast. I took her over to the dog park today just to kind of get her yayas out. And she had no yayas to get out. She just kind of walked around sniffing stuff. And when I was like, hey, ready to go? She's like, all right, let's go. I don't need the dog park today. I'm all worn out from yesterday where I ran around like an acre. They have like an acre of space. Three dogs just going nuts. My friend Scott Collins, he's been on the show a few times. His dog, Reggie, he was getting in on the action. But the nonstop party was Boba and Rosie, just going crazy the whole time. Anyway, so it was a good weekend, nice weekend. Gang, I have a great show for you today. There is, I have Justin Corsby, who is the writer-director of this new movie called Hard Luck Love Song. It was just in movie theaters, and today it goes to video on demand, VOD, as they say in the business. So like wherever you rent videos, Amazon, iTunes, wherever, it's available today, and I cannot recommend it enough. This movie is incredible. It's one of those movies that basically is about two people and their relationship and sort of like overcoming their own histories, their history together and their individual histories to try and get back together over the course of one night when a lot of madness happens. Has a lot of great actors in it. Eric Roberts is in it. Dermot Mulroney is in it. RZA is in it. The main guy, Michael Dorman, and the main woman, Sophia Bush, incredible actors. It's incredibly acted. It's beautiful and it's incredible. And the whole movie is based on a song by Todd Snyder, the song Just Like Old Times. So Justin Corsby went through that song and found a way to go into the places where he left some cracks. Like he'd say something and move on because it's a song. You don't have the whole time to explain this guy's backstory or that guy's backstory. So he actually went through and like filled in the cracks and created this night of insanity for these two people and everyone kind of around them. Hard Luck Love Song, amazing movie, amazing. It's just really, really good. And it's amazing to see that a movie without people in tights and exploding things can get, not that I have anything against that, but it seems like there's not a lot of movies that are just the story of people, human beings trying to relate over the course of a night and dealing with their shit. You know, incredible, incredible movie. You find it wherever it is that you rent movies. You can even do it on your cable or whatever if you still do that. Justin Corsby, turns out we knew each other back in the late 90s, early 2000s when I was in Gowdy. He worked at a place where my ex-wife worked, which is the 501 Studios here, which is a film complex where they used to have like gear and like post-production facilities and all this kind of stuff. And so our paths have crossed throughout the years. And he's a big fan, obviously, of music to go to this Todd Snyder song and make a whole movie about it. And the movie itself is loaded with amazing songs by people you know if you're from Austin, like guys like Daniel Johnston, Hayes Carl, Patrick Sweeney, Townes Van Zandt, Scott Byram. And you know it's deep Austin because he's got a song by Rusty Weir in there. He even has like a little special Continental Club placement. Like one of the girl lifts up a record at one point and holds it up, and it says the Continental Club on it with the logo and everything. So it's a great thing. Justin Corsby made a fantastic movie. It's called Hard Luck Love Song. Get out there and watch it. If you want to watch it before we listen to our conversation, that might happen. Or listen to what Justin has to say. It's a beautiful movie, beautiful story, incredibly well acted and beautifully shot. So without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with filmmaker Justin Corsby talking about his movie, Hard Luck Love Song. Let's get down.
Coke machine glowing through a parking lot. Called it a room with a view. Best night of pool that I ever shot. Beat a lot of money too. Looking for some company in the weekly scene. I seen I had to just had to be you. I ain't seen you since New Orleans.
Never. So we met before then.
Yeah, I think, you know, just kind of in passing here or there or whatever back. Like I said, like late 90s, early 2000s, probably.
Yeah.
I was working for, I'm from Austin, grew up in Austin and moved to New York, went to film school at NYU. And then I was back in Austin. I was working in the 501 Studios complex. And Tracy worked for like a sister company. I worked for the production company and she worked for the post-production company.
Right,
and
we were
friendly kind of. And, colleagues. And I remember, you know, I was just getting back into town and kind of plugging back into what was going on in the music scene. It was around the same time, you know, you were blowing up and you'd signed that big, you know, that major label deal and all that kind of stuff. And I remember it was just, you know, I was kind of in and around the music scene as well as the film scene and friendly with Tracy. And so there was like just a bunch of buzz around you and your band and stuff like that back then. I met you probably over there at 501 once and probably came to see you even.
Yeah.
Back then.
Well, cool, man. That's a great connection.
Yeah.
So, Hard Luck Love Song. This movie it's fucking great, dude. And it's beautifully shot too. Like the pool scenes, like the shooting pool scenes are very, they're beautiful.
Thank you. Yeah. We put a lot into that pool stuff. I kind of like to joke around on social media with Tom Cruise and Martin Scorsese. Tell them they better watch out. Jesse and Michael Dorman are coming for Vincent Loria from Color of Money. So.
Yeah. Dude. Were you a fan of pool movies growing up, or was that just part of the song that got you?
You know, a little bit of both. Just, you know, I did play a lot of pool kind of as like an adolescent and teenager and stuff. So like I liked pool. I'd seen The Color of Money, you know, back in the 80s when I was a kid or whatever. There was kind of a nine ball pool craze a little bit after that movie. And I remember my brother and I would play. We play eight ball, but we'd also play nine ball kind of back then because of that nine ball kind of pool craze after The Color of Money. So I was kind of, you know, into pool. I'm not like a great pool player, but I can play okay. But I've just spent a lot of times in dive bars and pool halls and juke joints and stuff like that. So, you know, it's kind of always been in and around the scene that I kind of hang out in or, you know, whatever. And then in the song, you know, what's amazing about the song is, he only really mentions pool in the song, maybe two lines or whatever, but there's just such a great framework in the song for kind of backstory and character and stuff like that. So that was really intriguing to me as a filmmaker and as a creative person. He says, you know, I won a tournament in Oklahoma City last week, hustled half this town tonight. And that's almost all he says about pool in the song. And then I'm like, wait a minute.
Right.
What happened in that scenario? Let's go back. Who were the people that you hustled? You know, how dangerous was the situation? How did you get from there to here and like fill in that kind of backstory? So it was a cool kind of framework writing prompt almost for me, you know, to be able to go, okay, in the song, he's here at the motel, the rundown motel already, but he's dropped these hints about what he did prior to getting there. And so that was like a cool kind of writing prompt for me to be able to go back and kind of flesh out kind of that kind of stuff and kind of set it up. You know, you set it up and it, you know, in the first act and then develop it in the second act. And then the third act, the, you know, the chickens come home to roost, so to speak. And so that was kind of a cool way to kind of set up the danger and tension, you know, that this guy's, you know, kind of lifestyle he's living, kind of, you know, you can put yourself in pretty dangerous situations if you keep running in that kind of lifestyle. So
yeah, that's so, but first of all, it really is an amazing movie, and I love it. I don't know exactly what all we can kind of cover without spoiling it, because it was really great. Something you don't really get to do a lot these days is when a movie's coming out, you kind of already know what you're going to see. You know what I mean?
And totally. Yeah. You know, these days trailers often kind of almost spell out the whole movie.
Yeah.
And they're, it's interesting. They're sort of kind of, you know, probably not unlike for musicians these days where they drop, you know, single after single after single up until the record release, and half the record's already been released before right. The record's released. So as a filmmaker, you sort of have the same kind of thing going on where you're like, you know, how much of this story do we want to reveal? You want audiences to be kind of on their toes and not, you know, really know everything going into it. And so there's a balance when you do a trailer, how much do you reveal? And, you know, you kind of have to touch on, you know, what the overall arc of the story is. And you need to highlight the actors who are going to draw people into the, you know, theater to see it and all that kind of stuff. So there's a real balance there. For me, as a person who likes to go see movies, like I really try to avoid watching trailers and reading reviews and those types of things. I'd rather, if it's a filmmaker I know and I know I like their work, I'd rather go in kind of cold and like have the experience kind of wash over me fresh without, you know, knowing very much about it at all.
Let me ask you a question about getting a movie like this made. I mean, at this point, is this it? Would this be classified in the sort of, oh, this is an art house movie? Or, but like, how hard is it to get a movie without anyone in tights? Or, you know, how hard is that to get money to make a movie to do that?
It's really challenging. Yeah. Really, really challenging right now. And the whole, not unlike what happened in the music business when everything went to streaming, it's like the whole apple cart has been upset. And so the structures that are in place for smaller movies to kind of get made and be discovered, it's so challenging now. And the theatrical marketplace is dominated by, you know, sequels and tentpole movies. And, you know, like you said,
people
you know, capes and pajamas. Yeah. And all that. And right now horror movies are still, you know, doing pretty well, but it's like, it's kind of a, you know, that's kind of to break through is really difficult. And then it's also challenging, you know, to raise the money and all that, you know, is also very difficult. Making a movie is just so expensive, right? So it's not like, and some people do make things in their garages or whatever and that catch fire and see the light of day, but it's not the same quite as, you know, being an independent artist, like a musician, maybe, where you could record a great album literally in your home these days. You can't quite do that with a film at the same level. So it's just such an expensive endeavor. It requires so many more people and so many more elements that go into it. It's really challenging. I think things will settle out, but right now we're in this weird kind of no man's land where it hasn't quite settled out, and COVID just kind of exacerbated, you know, that whole trend that was happening.
Right. So. There's a, you have the, what's his, JJ Geddes? What was his name?
Oh, yeah.
Over your shoulder.
Yeah, I'm a huge Chinatown fan.
Me
and
too,
a
man.
Fan of kind of that 70s kind of film, new Hollywood films. And a big noir fan too. So going back even before that,
that's what I was gonna say that I really liked about your movie is that there's a Stephen from the opening of it. There's like a stillness, and you're telling the story at your pace, and the whole film kind of takes place over a relatively very short amount of time, and so much is revealed in those things. Yeah. It took me back to sort of the spirit of those movies of that sort of 70s era.
Totally. Yeah. No, I'm a huge fan of those kind of 70s character dramas and whatnot, you know, from John Cassavetes and Hal Ashby and Bob Rafelson and, you know, all those, you know, great. I mean, even going to the late, you know, late 60s, Easy Rider and, you know, those types of films right. are kind of the films that, you know, as a kid who grew up in the 80s and 90s, I think we kind of look back to those films of the 70s as kind of like this beacon of artistic integrity and kind of more character driven stuff. And so I'm a huge fan of those. And you're right. Like the first half of this movie is basically an homage to that style of filmmaking, slow burn, really kind of, you know, I feel like you don't have to reveal everything about a character. You can reveal small little nuggets of backstory and let, you know, let the audience kind of fill in the rest. And you don't have to, you know, do so much exposition about what happened to somebody to break them and, you know, all these other kind of things that are kind of spelled out for audiences these days. I feel like you can kind of slowly peel those onion layers away and reveal those things. And so we really went for that in the, especially in the first half of the movie. It's kind of, I kind of describe it as like a rubber band being pulled back. It's like this slow pull back the rubber band. And then in the third act, we let it go and, you know, it fires off into orbit, you know, from there.
Right. That, there's, without giving too much away, the drugs and conversation in the hotel room thing and sort of the length of that scene is pretty incredible. it really, you get into that sort of like, oh,
Totally. Yeah. I wouldn't say I've been in that exact situation, but I've been in enough similar situations that I could really kind of imagine and flesh out kind of how those scenarios unfold between people. And, you know, it's there's the ups and downs, kind of a yo-yo that happens between people. And also, especially when substances are involved, there's the kind of euphoria and kind of fun part of it. And then, you know, there's something happens that, you know, a little small, you know, pee under the mattress kind of princess in the pea kind of thing happens right. where then all of a sudden there's this like tension and some edge that's presented and how quickly those little kind of small hiccups can then just drive that vibe and mood between people into a down period. And it's just that yo-yo that happens. And then, you know, you got to try to get out of that somehow. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. So let's talk about this. The whole movie Hard Luck Love Song is based on a Todd Snyder song called Just Like Old Times.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm a longtime Todd Snyder fan. And even going back, you know, I grew up in born in Austin, literally born in a house in Clarksville. A couple blocks from where, like, if you've ever seen the movie Heartworn Highways, the kind of old documentary featuring Townes Van Zandt and Guy Clark and all those people, there's some scenes in that documentary from the 70s where Townes Van Zandt is like holding court at this like trailer and house in Clarksville. And like, I was literally born a couple blocks, a couple years later after that, I was born in a house a couple blocks from there and kind of grew up in and around that kind of funky folk singer-songwriter kind of scene. My mom was friends with a bunch of those people. And I was, as a little kid, literally hung out in some of these kind of famous juke joint singer-songwriter bars that my mom's friends owned. And so I kind of grew up in and around that kind of Americana, kind of roots music kind of scene. Townes Van Zandt and Joe Ely, Butch Hancock, Jimmy Gilmore, Lucinda Williams, like that whole kind of scene of musicians that was in Austin in the 70s and 80s. And so Todd's kind of from that kind of,
yeah,
you know, kind of troubadour, kind of singer, songwriter, storyteller kind of mold. And so I got to see him play in the late 90s probably just kind of instantly was kind of mesmerized and blown away by what he does. He's such a unique talent, and I highly recommend people going and seeing him live. He's like almost like a stand-up comedian and storyteller as much as he is a musician. He's an amazing songwriter and very like just amazing, magical songwriter. But this show that he puts on where he tells these, like, he'll tell 15 minute stories that are poignant and sad and hilarious at the same time. And then he'll play, you know, these, you know, 3 or 4 minute songs that were kind of inspired by those stories or whatnot. And there's just such a unique kind of thing that he does that I was just captivated. And I was like, what could be done, you know, kind of in collaboration with him, or to kind of, you know, capture some of the magic that he has and bring that to film and television audiences. So for like probably 15-20 years, I was probably thinking about what could be done with Todd. And then one time I was watching him play in Austin at Hog Auditorium, and I just had a kind of lightning bolt of inspiration. He started playing the first few bars of this song, and I instantly was like, oh, this could make a really contained indie film. The song all takes place in a rundown motel. So I was like, oh, we could do this kind of on a smaller scale. It doesn't have to be a big, huge kind of studio kind of film. We could do it independently. And it's got all this great kind of framework for characters and for story that, you know, I think could be really interesting. And so it was literally after 15 years of thinking about it, just a spark of inspiration that happened, which, you know, that's kind of how creative works, right? You absorb a bunch of stuff. And then all of a sudden something happens and, it kind of pours out of you.
Yeah.
Like you're a vessel for some sort of higher creative being or something.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what happened here. So
did you know him at that point?
You know, I had met him a handful of times and had some mutual friends and had, you know, seen a ton of his shows, but I didn't know him personally. But I, as soon as that happened, I had that idea. I kind of fleshed out like what I thought the story would be, and the characters to some extent. Didn't want to get too far, you know, involved in it without getting the rights to the song and all that kind of stuff. So I kind of fleshed it out where it was pitchable. And then I reached out to his management and was like, hey, gave him some of my backstory and mentioned some of the mutual friends we had and stuff like that. And was like, hey, I've got this idea. I think it would be really cool. I think Todd would dig it. I'd love to sit down with Todd and kind of go through it. And so within a couple more weeks, I was sitting down with him, pitching him the idea, and we were kind of off to the races at that point. So it happened all very quickly. At least that first phase of it was, I had the idea, fleshed out the idea in a couple weeks, pitched him a couple weeks later, and we were off to the races. So very quick, for film development, process. It usually takes years to get something like that kind of even to that stage, but this happened pretty quick. So
that's pretty amazing. And I mean, you really ended up with just amazing actors in this movie.
Yeah, I feel very fortunate to be able to get the acting, the actors and the cast that we did around this film. It's not often on a first feature and on a small film like this that, you know, have such a kind of amazing cast of well-known actors and recognizable faces and just really talented folks. So yeah, pretty fortunate there. You know, a lot of times, you know, in a movie like this, you might end up with one person that people know or recognize, and then a bunch of, you know, really great character actors kind of built in around that. And that was kind of, you know, what people were kind of recommending. And I don't know. I have this like, kind of champagne taste and beer budget, and was like, no, let's try to get so-and-so for this. Let's try to get so-and-so for this. And, you know, I was told a couple times, like, you know, that I was maybe reaching too high with some of my aspirations for this. But ultimately, I think people really responded to the concept of it, being based on music. You know, music just inspires so many creative people. So like the idea of it being kind of a love letter to music and inspired by music, I think really appealed to people. And of course they like the script and the characters and stuff like that. But I think people just have such a fond place in their heart for music that, yeah, I think that really, and I'm passionate about music, so that really kind of spoke to a lot of the cast.
I know a lot of writers, and I find this kind of hard to believe, but one of my very best friends that I grew up with is like a professor and an author, and he has written novels and stuff, and he wanted me to introduce him to Bruce Robeson, because he was listening to Bruce Robeson music the whole time he was writing this one book. And he was just kind of like got in this groove where he just kept on listening to him. And I always thought it was weird because you're trying to write words, but you're hearing words too at the same time. Like, seems a little complicated.
Totally. Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I try to write to instrumental. If I'm going to listen to music while I'm writing, it's always instrumental music because I get distracted by the words and the stories of songs with lyrics. But if I'm trying to develop a vibe or a tone for a scene, I might go to a song that has lyrics and it kind of informs me kind of more big picture, more overall kind of like feeling of what a scene might be that I then kind of use, but not listening to the music while I write it. But right, right. I mean, I've been listening to like Beethoven while I write recently.
Right, right.
It's just, you know, it could be anything. It could be jazz. It could be, you know, classical. It could be anything instrumental can kind of get you in a groove and get you going. For me, it would be really challenging to write to lyrical stuff because different words kind of.
Yeah. You know what I was going to say is there's great punctuation with amazing music. Like in some of these scenes are punctuated by, I can't remember what the Scott Byram song was, but there was a great Scott Byram song that was on there that.
Oh yeah, still drunk, still crazy, still blue. That song, we love that song, and we were actually looking at a different song to end the film that I had kind of before I even made the film. I thought this will be the song that ends the film, but for whatever reason we tried the Scott Byram song, and I love Scott Byram and seen him play a million times, and that song just like kind of perfectly captured the tone. You know, there's like this fractured optimism that ends the film, right? It's like we don't know that it's going to work out
right
perfectly, and it might not work out, but at least tonight they're going to kind of enjoy the moment of, you know, kind of euphoria or whatever that's happening.
Survival
euphoria, I would say, maybe even, but there's something that's euphoric about that song but also broken at the same time, and it's like I'm still drunk, I'm still crazy, I'm still blue, but all right, we'll at least try to enjoy the moment. And that song kind of perfectly captured that vibe.
Yeah, there's something about that with everyone in this movie, man. It's really beautiful on that level. Like there's like a level of no matter how fucked up these people are, there is this weird sort of care to them. You know,
totally. Yeah. There's a lyric in the song that kind of ends the film, which is they're living out their own kind of American dream. And I really thought about that a lot. You know, for some people it's suburban house, white picket fence and all that. And for other people, it's like pool party at a cheap motel at 4 a.m. with their friends and a bunch of booze or whatever. And you know, not everybody lives the same kind of life and same kind of lifestyle. And like what I love about storytelling songs is they're often a window into kind of characters and worlds that we don't often see. And so, you know, I really kind of enjoy this scene of people that are portrayed in the movie. And I think there's just like a, you know, as challenging as it is to be kind of working class or working creative class, sometimes there's a level of enjoyment of the little things that happens. And I really embrace that. So it's like kind of finding adventure. And, you know, like I said, it could be a pool party at 4 a.m. at a rundown motel that, you know, it just is that perfect, special, euphoric moment.
Yeah.
At least that week or whatever.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I tried to kind of embrace that for sure.
You know, it's funny. I thought that Dermot Mulroney's character, the crazy dude, it seemed like a part that Eric Roberts would have played like 25 years ago, doesn't it? Or 20 years ago?
Totally. No. Yeah. 100%. And, you know, it's interesting that you say that because the Lewis character that RZA plays.
Yeah.
When RZA and I were talking about it before Eric Roberts was even cast in the movie, he's like, have you ever seen that movie Star 80 with Eric Roberts where he's this like obsessed, you know, jealous boyfriend? He's like, I'm gonna channel that for this. And so then I was like, oh, well, guess what? Eric Roberts is actually in the movie.
Yeah.
There was, I think there is some of that. And, you know, even, you know, to some extent, if you look at Michael Dorman and the Jesse character and skip the Eric Roberts character, it's like they're sort of generational parallels between them as well. So
yeah, definitely.
I think the movie has a lot of that kind of stuff to it, where it's like you could see this actor playing this other role, you know, 20 years earlier, or you could see this character is actually will ultimately maybe become this other character. We tried to kind of make those connections from a casting standpoint and from kind of a character development and story standpoint.
There's like some beautiful exchanges and dialogue, and even that one between what's his name, Michael Dorman, the guy that plays Jesse.
Yeah, Michael Dorman. Yeah,
mm-hmm. That guy's fucking great, man. But just their exchange at the bar there when she goes off to the bathroom is beautiful. Like the whole sort of how it starts off volleying, and then they get behind the walls and they connect. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. And they connect over music, really, too. That scene is actually kind of inspired by, there's a Kris Kristofferson song called "To Beat the Devil." And then Todd Snyder has a song called "Ballad of the Devil's Backbone Tavern." And that scene is kind of inspired by both of those two songs. And that volleying back and forth that happens between those two characters, they're like quoting songs, you know. So like Eric Roberts says, "I was born in a Mexican whorehouse." And Jesse says, "Across the street from a Catholic church." Which is kind of a riff on the Tom Waits song, Mr. Siegel, so there's that. And then Eric Roberts says, "Sounds like you've been reading my mail," which is a line from "To Beat the Devil," the Kris Kristofferson song. Okay. And so he says, "No, it sounds like I stole your record collection." So they're like volleying back and forth with these little kind of insider musical kind of Easter eggs. And then that helps them, like, you know, it's like people who are big music fans or big movie fans, even, like, they have their little kind of things that they can reference that other people who get them understand what they're saying.
Yeah.
And so that's what that scene is about, is like the music, this love of music kind of breaks down this wall between them. And then they kind of get into the more personal connection, like you mentioned.
Where did you find Michael Dorman? Where did he come from?
Yeah, good question. You know, very challenging. This role requires so much. We were looking for kind of a needle in a haystack here. And we were down the path with some actors who could play some music. We were also down the path with some musicians who were kind of crossing over to become actors. Because it's, you know, there are lots of actors who play music or have side bands or stuff like that. But, you know, those bands are usually okay. They're passable, but they're not usually like, they just don't usually have like whatever that extra gear of soul and, you know, personal kind of struggle that goes into making music so special. And although they have that on the acting side typically. And so we were really looking for that kind of, we really needed someone who was believable and was an amazing actor, but also could really play music and sing. And we needed somebody who could shoot pool on top of that. So extra degree of difficulty. So we were down the path with a couple of actors, and Michael's management company sent over the pilot to this show on Amazon that he did called Patriot. And if you haven't seen it, it's an incredible show. It's like a dark comedy. He plays an undercover CIA operative who's like in Europe, like assassinating people and doing, you know, undercover CIA stuff. But because he can't tell anyone what he does, on the side, he plays folk music in coffee shops and kind of sings about who he really is in a coded kind of songwriter kind of way. And it's sort of like his mental health regimen to kind of, you know, keep him sane since he can't tell anybody what he does. And so we saw that. It's an amazing show. And about halfway through, he plays this Townes Van Zandt song, "If I Needed You." And my producing partner, Allison, who's also my wife, and I just looked at each other and we're like, all right, this is the guy. You know, he can act, you know, he's an incredible actor. And here he is playing music and playing, you know, kind of roots music, folk music that kind of is important to what this, you know, film is. And coincidentally, Allison walked down the aisle to that Townes Van Zandt song when we got married. Wow. So it was this like kind of extra layer of kismet that just, you know, happened. And so we were like, all right, forget about the rest of these other actors. This guy, Michael Dorman, is the real deal. And he's, you know, he's from New Zealand. He's a Kiwi.
Oh, he is?
He kind of came up through. Yeah, he's a Kiwi. He came up through Australia and was fairly successful actor on television and movies in Australia. And then he landed this role in this show Patriot. And that's kind of what brought him to the U.S. and kind of springboard for his career. And he's done a fair amount of, he had an Apple show called For All Mankind, the space race show that he was the co-star of.
Oh, cool.
And he was in that Invisible Man horror movie that came out last year or whatever. Yeah.
Dude, that movie was great.
Yeah, and he's in that. He's like the lawyer brother.
Right. It's funny because like to guys like us that were around, say like 20 years, like right down to the fucking Pearl Snap shirt he's wearing. Like I know 50 dudes that are that guy. You know what I mean?
Totally. Yeah.
That have been
absolutely.
That have been around. And, for you know, a while.
He is. He was dedicated artist. He lost weight for it. I showed him some pictures of, he got to meet Todd Snyder and all that kind of stuff, but I showed him some pictures of Justin Townes Earl, Steve Earle's son, passed away last year, but who was like kind of rail thin rock star Americana, you know, dude. So I showed him some pictures of Justin as some inspiration and, he lost a bunch of weight for it. He didn't smoke, but he took up smoking for the role. And he went and trained. He had shot plenty of pool before, but he went and trained with like a world champion billiards champion guy in Australia. Went and trained with him for months to get ready for it. Yeah, so he was all in. And he used to play in bands when he was younger. Hadn't really played that much.
It's got a nice voice.
Until incredible voice. Yeah.
He does such a good job. There's that smoking thing is funny that you say that because I just quit smoking like 2.5 months ago. And that was the first time like I was seeing everybody. So I was like, God damn, man, I want a cigarette really bad.
There's almost not a scene in the movie when he doesn't have a cigarette in his mouth.
Right.
And it was, I mean, he was, like I said, he was committed to the bit. I think he quit smoking now, hopefully. He was all in. And you know, when you're making a movie, when you're shooting indoors, you know, you can't smoke inside anymore, you know, and you can't expose all the crew who are in close, you know, quarters with you to that kind of stuff. So, he smoked herbals when we were close proximity with other people, but like anytime we were not inside, he was like, no, I'm going for the real thing.
Oh, wow. So,
yeah. He's a tremendous actor. He just, you know, he just brought so much to it. Even just like little, small little things that, you know, as a writer, it's really great. You know, you write it out and a lot of it's there on paper, but the magic really happens. There's like an alchemy that happens or something when you turn the camera on and the actors are doing their thing. And probably not unlike, you know, when you go into do stuff with the band, you know, it's just some magic that happens between people or what have you. And that really happens between actors. And it also just, even when it was just him and me and the camera, you know, like, you know, when we were just stripped down to having him kind of live his little lonely existence, like just some of the kind of things, the choices that he would make and the things that he would do that were not called for in the script or that I had no idea were coming were just amazing. Like in the beginning, when he bounces on the bed and does all that, you know, jumping on the bed, like he completely just did that in the moment. And it was so magical and perfect for the character. And we were like, yeah, amazing.
Right. Well, it's funny because it opens with this, and I'm going to ask you if this was, obviously it probably was your choice, but there's this thing, there's this sort of collage of this guy's lonely existence, but you're getting an idea emotionally through each different scene that he's in. you're getting a taste of he's been through something. You're getting all this stuff. But when he hugs the homeless dude, like, it just, like, that's when you're like, oh, like, that guy, he's a good guy, man. Yeah. He's trying. You know what I mean? I don't know what he did, exactly, but he's trying to be a good guy, man. Yeah.
It's yeah, exactly. And a lot of people ask about the hugging because he kind of hugs.
Especially now, because know what I mean? You're like, he's hugging strangers. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Totally. Yeah, it's so weird to see people that I'm good friends with and I don't know whether to hug them or shake their hands or give them a fist bump or whatever. Yeah. So, but yeah, no, that was an interesting thing that I decided fairly early on to write that into the script and into his character as a way for us to see that he really likes, you know, he's looking for human connection and he really likes to, you know, he wants to know everybody. Yeah. And so that was one of the things that we wrote in there as a way that the audience can really kind of see that he's struggling through some personal demons and stuff, but also see kind of this humanity in him and kind of connect with him. And it's funny, I was talking with the actor who played the homeless guy the other day, and basically everything you just said, you know, the audience has been reacting the same way. And had a nice conversation with Christian, the guy that plays the homeless guy. And I was explaining to him, it's like, you know, that moment unlocks so much for the main
so
character.
Much. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and he, Christian was like, oh, I'm happy to be a small part in your amazing movie or whatever. And that was very sweet of him to say. And I was like, no, you're a critical part of this movie. Without this moment of connection that happens between the two of you, like, I'm not sure that we, you know, are able to go down this path with the character in the same way, with the main character in the same way. So like, all of these smaller supporting roles are all fairly crucial to developing the character and then kind of how the story kind of unfolds as well. And so, yeah, that humanity is kind of, and looking, you know, loneliness, you know, we're all kind of on our own in this world, and trying to find connection with other people is like kind of what it's all about. So that was kind of one of the big themes for the movie. And that scene kind of starts that ball rolling, I think. So.
Yeah. Man, you did such a great job. So is this, how many movies have you made?
Like, this is my first narrative feature. I've had a long career, been fortunate to have a successful career directing TV commercials. So I have a company that I started, I think 19 years ago or something now, when I was 25. And I have started this company, and primarily does TV commercials. So we get hired by big ad agencies and big brands to do TV commercials. And that's been really fun and rewarding, you know, creative outlet for me. And also, you know, the budgets are usually pretty good, and you know, it's been a real great proving ground for me to be able to, and I've directed some big commercials with lots of different, you know, high end production values and stuff like that. So while this is my first time to do a feature film, it's not my first time behind the camera. I've had a lot of time behind the camera and a lot of time on set. So this, you know, somebody maybe a few years younger than me maybe would have made a smaller movie with, you know, less resources and stuff like that. But I felt like since I had done kind of these bigger commercials and all these other things and kind of, you know, really honed my craft over the last, you know, 10 years or so.
Right.
That I could kind of jump into something. It's not a big movie by any means, but something, you know, with a little bit more resources than maybe some other people's first time films.
Well, it's gorgeous. Like, you're a fantastic fucking director, man.
Wow. Thank you.
I love about the movie. There's no cell phone.
Yeah.
In the movie.
That was a choice we made. And there was even some dialogue when he checks into the motel where he tells the manager of the motel that he doesn't use a cell phone, you know, but that ended up getting cut and it's not in the film, but and it was fine not to explain why he doesn't have a cell phone, but yeah, we just thought cell phones would be kind of like this weird kind of distracting element to like the story. The story, it's modern, but it's kind of timeless at the same time.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we wanted to kind of Todd Snyder kind of riffing on this a little bit. Todd Snyder also has a song about his vinyl record collection, and he basically leaves his bag and all his clothes behind because he can only bring one bag, and he brings his records. And so like I kind of wanted that idea for this character, which is like he's going to leave the kind of the more modern stuff that he doesn't need behind. And what's important to him is, you know, these certain few things. So he carries that record player around and carries his records right, around. Right. And part of that kind of idea is also like he lives without a computer and without a cell phone, basically.
Right.
And tries to look for, you know, more like on the streets, more, you know, human connection with people out in the world. And he's an adventurer. He wants to go out and meet people and kind of connect and meet people where they live and connect with people. And, you know, part of that is, you know, as I'm sure you can relate to, is like gathering humanity and creative inspiration for, yeah, you know, his craft, you yeah know? And I embrace that myself quite a bit too. So it was something that, and I know songwriters definitely do that. So it was something I wanted to kind of, you know, embed into this character, like that kind of, old school approach to life and connections, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. It's important to have that. I mean, it's funny that you say that it would be distracting from the story to have it in there. And when you said that, I was like, yeah, it's fucking distracting to your day-to-day story every day. You know what I mean?
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, yeah. It's, oh man, we're all addicted to them and it's insane.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question. I have a cousin that does wardrobe for commercials. Do you know Emily Antonetti?
The name sounds familiar, but is she in Austin?
Yes. Are you not in Austin?
I'm in LA today. I split my time kind of between LA and Austin. So
okay.
I'm in LA today. But yeah, I spend a lot of time there and I'm from there, obviously. And we have an office there and do a lot of my commercials there as well. Although they kind of take me all over the country and even out of the country these days. But yeah, the name sounds familiar. I'll have to kind of go back and see. I wouldn't be surprised if she was on one of our call sheets and, you know, one of our projects over the years.
Yeah. The movie's coming out in theaters or is out in theaters?
Out in theaters, and we're kind of winding down the theatrical window. It's in a few theaters, but you know, it opened on the 15th several weeks ago, and was in, you know, a couple hundred theaters. And the way it works is it goes kind of wider, and then kind of trickles down, you know, kind of ratchets down, and kind of goes out to smaller communities and stuff like that. And then I think it just got announced yesterday, or is being announced today, that November 9th. It's going to be available on video on demand. So it'll still be in some limited theaters, but it'll be available on VOD on Amazon or iTunes or
yeah,
you know, wherever, you know, people rent stuff. And that's how people are seeing smaller movies these days. You know, the people go to the theater, see kind of the bigger tentpole movies, and these smaller movies like this kind of really do, you know, get most of their exposure on VOD and streaming and whatnot. We were fortunate to get a exclusive theatrical window as well, which is, you know, kind of one of the things that kind of raises the profile of the movie. And, you know, you get reviewed by the major, you know, outlets, and it's sort of a check mark next to the film that says, hey, this isn't just a straight to video kind of film. This is like,
right,
you know, a serious film. And,
yeah,
and so then people know by the time it gets to VOD, they've already heard about it because there was enough awareness built during the theatrical kind of frame. So,
yeah. That's great, man. I wish, is it playing in Austin in theaters?
You know, I think it just finished its Austin run.
That sucks.
Yeah. But, we were there on the 15th. We actually did like kind of a premiere in Austin, at the Arbor, theater, which is kind of an old school art house theater. And it played at a handful of theaters in Austin, but we did it there and packed house, a bunch of people, friends and family, and some actors came, and we did that. And then we did like a big after party over at the Sagebrush down on South Congress.
I love
Congress.
That place.
So cool, man. It's funny. I showed pictures of the white horse to our production, our art department production design team when they were designing the honky tonk bar for the inn.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I hadn't been to the Sagebrush. We shot the movie, you know, Sagebrush wasn't even open when we filmed it. But then I went to the Sagebrush and I told Dennis, the owner, I was like, basically your bar looks like our movie. Like they're almost like spitting images of each other, pool tables and honky tonk and, you know, all that kind of grit and grime of, you know, days of yore. So I loved it. Yeah.
You know what I thought was great was your Continental Club plug. When she lifts up one of the 45s and holds it up, I was like, all right.
Oh, yeah. I talked to Steve about it. I was like, hey, they're going to do cocaine on this. There's going to be cocaine on this Continental Club thing. Are you okay with that? And he's like, I hope millions of people see it, is what he said. So I thought that was hilarious.
Yeah, it's
yeah,
good.
You know, I spent a lot of time at the Continental Club. It's a real important place to me. And, you know, when I'm in town, I go there to hear music all the time. And now I go to Seaboys quite a bit now that Seaboys is opened. And yeah, I just, you know, the Austin music scene is such a kind of critical kind of input for me as a creative person, from the singer songwriter joints that I hung out in as a kid to when I was like a, you know, 9, 10, 11 year old, I hung out at Liberty Lunch watching like punk bands and kind of that whole kind of alt rock bands that were happening in the 80s there.
Yeah.
And then, you know, just everywhere on from there too, Black Cat and you know, all the places, emos and, you know, all those places. So yeah, it's kind of, I tried to, this film, you know, as well, it's based on a song and certainly inspired by Todd Snyder. There's a ton of real personal kind of elements in the film as well. Like that Dead Milkman shirt that Michael Dorman wears, like that was my shirt when I was a 10-year-old.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I pulled that out of like some drawer that I had, like been saving it forever. And I used to wear it from time to time, but I haven't worn it lately. That was like my personal shirt from that I got at Liberty Lunch when they were playing at Liberty Lunch when I was like probably 10 years old, and they all signed it and stuff. And that was cool. And I kind of knew the band a little bit through some family friends, and I even sang on one of their albums. Like they had like a kid's chorus and I
wow, that's awesome.
Albums. Yeah. Yeah. So like that. And then like the Daniel Johnston song that Michael Dorman plays.
Yeah.
Like, you know, that's like a callback to when I was a little juvenile delinquent skate punk kid hanging out at the Drag and at Sound Exchange and buying Daniel's handmade tapes and all that. And it's just, you know, all of these things that have kind of been my input over the years, you know, I didn't spend them all, but there's a good amount of kind of personal stuff that I kind of hid as little Easter eggs or kind of poured into the film as kind of personal touches that, you know, mean a lot to me, but also I think people who know, it's like, you know, kind of the kind of movie nerd or music nerd kind of thing in me, like the people who know and it was a lot of fun being able to do that.
So. Well, man, I'm really stoked that you were able to get this in theaters and that I'm glad that it got the push it deserves. It's like a thing that happened a few years ago. Did you ever see that movie Hell or High Water?
Oh, I love that movie.
Me too. So I love the shit, man. I saw that movie. I freaked out. And then when it got nominated for an Oscar, I was like, man, thank God. You know, even though it didn't win, just the fact that like, because movies are, you know, can be great and not be like, you know.
Yeah, that movie's so good. And I feel like it's really challenging for me. Like the sweet spot for me is a movie like that where it's artistically done, but it's also commercial and can go wider, you know, and find an audience. And I really strive to make movies that are, you know, this first one that I did is smaller and, you know, it's going to be more of a, you know, kind of a niche thing.
Right, right.
But like I really strive to make movies that are more kind of in that kind of mid ground. And they're just not making those middle-sized movies anymore. It's like everything's either really small and niche or everything's really big and, you know, spandex and tentpole.
Right.
And it's tough, man. It's in a weird transition and it's hard. I encourage people to go out and hear independent music and go out and see independent film. And it's kind of on us as the community
That's
to be able to keep that stuff going. And so it's our things are so fractured these days with so many distractions and so many things. It's hard to even to, you know, find things these days because there's so much and onslaught of information. And so like, try to encourage everybody, try to find good music and go see it. Try to, and go buy it from the artist at the merch table, you know, rather than put actual dollars in their pocket rather than the few pennies they get, you know, fractions of pennies that they get from the streamers and stuff like that. And same thing with independent film and any art in general. Like it's up to us to, you know, cultivate that and keep it going.
So, yeah. I'm trying to find a calendar. I'm going to try and put this out on November 9th or whatever show would fall around November 9th. So that way,
people can see it
on demand. Justin, you made a really great movie, man. You really did. Thank you so much for doing the show too. And I guess it's an honor to get to see you again.
Yeah. It's been maybe 20, probably 20 years.
Now we're old dudes. Do you ever see Tracy anymore?
You know, I haven't probably in probably maybe 15 years or something, you know?
Yeah.
I may be friends with her on Facebook. I'm not 100% sure. I think, as far as I know, she's still kind of plugging away and doing film stuff and all that. But I haven't seen her. But you know, that was kind of like right when I got out of film school and was like breaking into the industry, and she was a young creative person also kind of doing the same thing. I think a few years older than me, but you know, kind of like all these musical experiences I had, those are kind of seminal days of, you know, what form you as an artist. So yeah. I tend to remember like those people that I met kind of in the early stages of my career for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of cool people. Dude, whenever I go over to that Whole Foods now sometimes. That's over there.
I saw that the other day. I was like, oh my God, what is going on over here?
Yeah, it's pretty weird.
There's like a city Target and a Whole Foods?
Yeah.
All right there? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah. Well, Justin, everyone get out there and check out Hard Luck Love Song, a gorgeous movie written and directed by Justin Corsby and inspired, or it's based on the song Just Like Old Times by Todd Snyder. That's how you say it, right? Inspired by or based on?
Yeah, I kind of use both a little bit. Yeah.
What a great
either
thing.
One.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to whatever it is you do next. And stay in touch. I hope I see you around out there, maybe at Continental Club or Seaboys at some point.
Hell yeah. Yeah. I'll hit you up next time I'm in town going to hear music and see what you're up to.
Excellent, man. Great.
All right. Thanks,
great talking
honey.
To
appreciate
you, man.
It, man.
See you, man.
You too.
I ain't seen you since New Orleans. Never did figure out where you run off to.
That's Justin Corsby, writer, director of the new movie Hard Luck Love Song, going to video on demand today. VOD, as they call it in the business. You can find it on iTunes, Amazon, or your cable stuff. Wherever it is that you rent the movies, you can rent Hard Luck Love Song today. Get out there and check it out. Great talking to Justin. What a nice guy. What a great, great movie. I'd really like to catch up with him and talk to him about more stuff. He, really great taste in music too, right? You check out the rest of this song, Just Like Old Times by Todd Snyder. That's the song that it's based on. I should have said that in the intro, but I didn't. I'm sorry, I forgot. I'd like to thank Justin for coming on the show. Get out there and watch Hard Luck Love Song today. Beautiful movie, okay? Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast wherever it is that you find podcasts, be it Spotify, TuneIn, Overcast, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, new shows every Tuesday, every Friday, sometimes three shows a week. In that case, they'd be Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Once again, thanks to Justin Corsby. Get out there and see the movie Hard Luck Love Song. Enjoy the rest of this song, Just Like Old Times, what the movie's based on by Todd Snyder. All right? Have a great week, whatever it is you're doing. Let's get down.
Town tonight. I got some cocaine if you want some. The best that I could find. We could just sit here and talk all night. If that big old guy out in the car don't mind. Like old times. A screw off a top on a bottle of wine. Living out a different kind of American dream. Old times, your goal was always the same as mine. You didn't want to throw a fishing line in that old mainstream. No, I ain't expecting anybody but you. I don't know who that could be at the door. But I'm pretty sure that you got a clue, and I bet you've been to this hotel before. But do you know what in the bathroom? But don't flush it down just yet. Put your pager in my suitcase, I'll get the window, you light a cigarette. It'll be like old times, just like the old times, living out a different kind of American dream. Old times, your goal was always the same as mine. You didn't want to throw a fishing line in that old main stream. No, sir, officer, you don't understand. We're just two old friends drinking wine. I'm sure she is, but that's not all she is. She is also an old friend of mine. I got her high school picture right here in my wallet, 1982. No, sir, officer, no offense to you. You have a good night, too. Good thing we didn't throw this away. Baby, turn up that radio. I'm pretty sure that cop knew what we were up to. I guess he just decided to let us go. Oh, don't make such a thing about the picture. That was just something I kept. But don't get all sentimental on me now, girl. You haven't even told me what your new name is. Yeah, my old time. This is like the old times, living our own kind of American dream. Old times, your goal was always the same as mine. You didn't want to throw a fishing line in that old mainstream, and you didn't